Folder 13. Early 1979. 13.4. I am plugging into a giant idea computer. I am the next step up in evolution, which, because the next step up plugs into this giant idea computer, has a virtually infinite mind. My Jungian intuitive possibilities function in my right hemisphere like a photon gun. I have two protection devices to conceal my identity. One, scramble pattern of all ideas at once to bury my idea of my true nature and origin. And two, amnesia. We came to this planet from elsewhere. There is no way I can sort the true ideas out of all the infinitude of equally plausible mere possibilities. Somewhere in a near-infinite bulk of ideas lies the truth. But which? But this device is necessary. Who and what I am, the actual situation, is hopelessly occluded off from me by this scramble pattern of endless self-negating dialectic idea permutations at infinite velocity. Hence, as I realized a couple of weeks ago, although I may know the truth and even speak it, I am doomed not to know which of the many conflicting truths generated in me it is. It could be any of them. So I know the truth about myself, but due to this device, paradoxically, do not know. Thus the idea computer conceals itself by its own idea-generating capacity. Its basic function is its own camouflage. Ah, hier ist Zebra Vader. Note. German. Here is Zebra again. End note. Another way to camouflage itself. This shows up not just when I try to figure out myself, but when I try to figure out, conceptually pin down, Zebra. I can't give the same account twice regarding 374, regarding Zebra, and regarding myself. We're interwoven. I guess, but here again, the camouflage device, this time an idea scramble, works, analogous to its physical camouflage. This suggests that I and the life form Zebra are one. No, we may just be related, etc., etc. See? See how it works? I did have one insight, not based on thinking, but on my feeling toward the animals, that I am the, a Buddha, but must conceal my identity as Siddhartha even to myself. My whole thinking is just a cover for my real nature, my feeling regarding those who suffer. I am a feeling disguised by mere flack thinking. My feelings are reliable, but my thoughts are not. 13.6. My powers came from the other side because of my sister. AI voice and plugged into an idea computer. Audio and video. Pictures. I saw my abstract ideas graphically. Is Valis a computer? I think I've solved it. I came to the conclusion a long time ago that the dialectic represented a computer. Are we in a computer program and stationary? As Zeno proved, motion is impossible. All is thought. 13.9. Perhaps my most important realization while loaded is, what is implied in the way of paradoxes if the statement, every idea thought of is true, but for no measurable length of time, because it, i.e. its truth, is instantly negated by an equal and opposite idea, and so forth, is true. The infinity of the first part, every idea thought of is true, is dialectically balanced by the null infinity, but for no measurable length of time, because it is inexorably replaced by the dialectic generation of its opposite. What such an infinity countered by an antithetical infinity would lead to is, one, an infinite number of universes, of, two, no measurable duration, from outside, but in each universe, there would be what I must regard as a pleroma of spurious subjective time, sufficient within the universe, but not there when viewed from outside that universe. What I deduced from this is that each self passes through an infinitude of universes or frames, each with laws, truths of its own. But the permutation being so fast, instantaneous, no memory of it is laid down by the self, whose entire memory is instantly derived from situational cueing generated within and by whatever frame he is now in. However, some truths could, in the intrinsic statement of them, contain as part of their definition that of ubiquity, in which case what I call sustains would be created which would lay down memory. But since other aspects of the frames would differ from one another, one's true memory would be of serial disjunctions along the linear time axis without any apparent explanation. E.g., I was born in Chicago in 1928, but an instant ago I was living in 1st century A.D. Rome, viz. 1st century A.D. Rome and USA 1974 both contained the same sustain, the golden fish sign. But no other sustains. Nonetheless, the self passed from 1st century Rome directly to USA 1974 due to the golden fish sign, but drew ersatz memory of life in modern USA generated by situational cues in this frame. There is an explanation, and it lies in what I call sustains, which resemble the form axes I described in Ubik, and which do not lie along linear time, but rather sustained time, which is my word for Plato's eternal forms. For consciousness of this to open up true memory, the self would discover that it had existed for an infinite length of time in, through, the permutations of an infinitude of different universes, and knew ideationally everything. 13:12, 4:30 a.m. Valis itself as an experience or an entity in itself generates a multiple or split model parallel possible explanations dialectic. So, it must lie in that realm. There can be only an infinite series of equally true explanations generated. Vision. A dark-haired young woman lying in a coffin. She is dead. She is my sister. She is, or she generated, the perturbation in the reality field, i.e. Valis. It is a projection into this world of her mind to protect me. The vision came in response to my question, who perturbed the reality field? Is the AI voice hers? Now that I think of the vision, it suggests Ella Runciter in Ubik. Perhaps my sister's benign influence over me thus shows up in my writing. Note. In the novel Ubik, Ella Runciter exists in half-life, a state of cryonic suspension that allows her to communicate with the living for a short period of time after death. End note. 13:13. The Encyclopedia of Philosophy says, the virtues instilled by suffering could be achieved another way. How does it know that? That they could be achieved another way. Here the error lies. These virtues are essential, and there is no other way. A certain aesthetically, graphically beautiful heroism is inevitably generated to all humans. All. All become as Christ, none less than Jesus. All men, creatures, suffer as he, hence are equal to him, and therefore are him, dramatically, as in a sacred ritual drama, therefore us all. Christ was an Egyptianized Greek Apollo, i.e., very early Greek statues. What knowledge do we get from Jesus' life and death? That one, we are innocent by reason of our unmerited suffering. And two, if innocent and made to suffer, then heroic. And three, if heroic, transfigured, resurrected into godhood, all of us, as a species, and the beasts too, all life. 13:15. All artists know they can't avoid suffering, and out of it they forge their art in defiance. Artist or not, they will suffer. Art is the ultimate defiance of fate. The heroic act deliberately done. I saw this in the rat I had to kill. Innocence and heroism and terrible beauty, nobility, in a mere rat. Oh God, there is nothing we know that the creatures don't know. They are our equals. 13:21. Is it possible that any human or creature could, under the right circumstances, experience anamnesis and recall its Christ self? Tragedy, the evil scene, and the good guessed at. One senses, but cannot clearly see, the hidden good rational invading the palpable evil irrational, and sees, as the result of this antithetical clash, apotheosis. Valis, a mysterious hidden moral order, good and rational, behind the visible, chaotic, and evil and deterministic, which can be appealed to. The slain God proliferates down through the cosmos to each rat and cockroach. 13:22. Coleridge on Tragedy. The greatest effect is produced when the fate is represented as a higher intelligent will. The human will was exhibited as struggling with fate. Note. Paraphrase from Coleridge's essay, Shakespeare's English Historical Plays, which appears in The Literary Remains of Samuel Coleridge, Volume 2, 1836. End note. So the essence of tragedy is the limited human knowledge, plans, hopes, desires, will, clashing with a higher and intelligent will, which we understand or encounter as fate, fate defined as that power or those powers capable of arranging our outcome. Note, another new mood is here announced in the exegesis, a tragic dialectics. Dick has come across Coleridge's understanding of tragedy, which adapts the early ideas of F. W. J. Schelling held that the essence of tragedy consists in a collision between the tragic hero who is free and fate, which is the limitation of freedom, the realm of necessity. The sublimity of tragedy consists in the demonstration of freedom in the confrontation with that which destroys it. This is what we see, for example, in the tragedy of Oedipus. Tragedy is here linked to the idea of suffering leading to an experience of truth, as when Aeschylus says repeatedly in the Orestia, "We must suffer, suffer into truth." These tragic insights might also be linked to Dick's repeated references to Euripides' Bacchae, in particular, the collision between King Pentheus, bad, and the god Dionysus, good. These also look forward to a closing passage in this collection where Dick describes the exegesis as a collision between himself and what oneself has writ. On this view, the exegesis might be interpreted as the entirely self-conscious enactment of a tragic dialectics that moves between the poles of suffering and salvation. S.C. End note. The plans the protagonist has are not in harmony with a higher and intelligent will, which has the power to decide the outcome. There is no way the man's plans can win out, so individual plan is forcibly harmonized even if this requires that it be pulverized, i.e., can't be harmonized and still remain intact. The loss of that intactness is the essence of tragedy, the antithetical dialectic between his plan and fate's plans, with the latter, by definition, prevailing. I do not see that his 1. Learning by reason of this, or contrarily, 2. Failing to learn, adds or subtracts from the manifestation of the truly tragic, since to me the latter is more pitiful and the former more constructive. In fact, I see the latter, too, as more tragic, if either is, which violates classic notions of tragic drama. I say disproportionate suffering, pain, disappointment, loss, is the essence of tragedy because its disproportion renders the victim, however evil or guilty, veridically innocent, made spotless by the overbearing quality or quantity of suffering. Tragedy is when the punishment is not just. And I say every living creature is punished disproportionately. So every life is a tragic one. Disproportionate suffering is the ubiquity of the condition of having lived. Yet a mystery is hinted at, a rectification of this disproportion. Not through the vile lie that man, creatures, are sinful and deserve their suffering, but rather, but this precisely is the mystery, the invasion of this irrational system by the rational, in which an invisible and elusive mitigation of tribulation is injected according to some hidden order of theodicy, not directly seen. Thus, whereas the disproportionate tribulation is directly seen, and its reality not open to conjecture, dispute, or denial, the mitigation or even transmutation of the tribulation into something proportionate, just, or even beneficial must be guessed at. And this intuitive guess is the kingpin of religion and the religious solution to implacable tragedy as it exists ubiquitously in the real world and not in art. Tragedy as an interim reading of life between religion on the one hand and Satanism or pessimistic materialism on the other. Basic to tragedy is the equilibrium of the evil that is observed and the good that is guessed at. What is central is the balance between an intense awareness of pain or evil, which is clearly revealed, and an intuitive apprehension of a transcendent realm of values. In each case, evil is affirmed, but it is transcended by a higher good which induces exaltation, not despair or faith. The balance is destroyed when evil is denied or seen as remedial or is affirmed as ultimate. Note. Extensive paraphrase drawn from Una Ellis Fermor's essay, The Equilibrium of Tragedy, which appears in Shakespeare's Drama, 1980. End note. I suppose in terms of what Coleridge says, the higher intelligent will, which we call fate, is proved right in the end, i.e., it is proved to be just that, a higher intelligent will, and not fate in the sense of blind or malignant evil or purposelessly cruel force or forces as such. It is the revelation that fate is not fate, but a wiser, higher, and more powerful will contending with, overruling, man's will out of its higher intelligence. It disagrees because it knows more. But this does not inspire faith and is not accepted, known, on or by faith. Exaltation comes not from faith, which would provide only passive acceptance or resignation, but from an encounter with fate, seen in the aspect of higher and more intelligent, i.e., sentient and planning will. The exaltation is derived from knowledge of, not faith concerning. That which had masked itself as fate, in mimesis, reveals this camouflage, and in stepping forth acts in revelation of a deliberately hidden, different, even opposing nature. It is not fate at all. Higher intelligent will is not fate, if the term is to retain its correct meaning. Something or someone has mimicked fate, perhaps supplanting it invisibly, replacing it perhaps by insidiously devouring it and substituting itself for it in perfect imitation at its source. This is a staggering mystery. But mystery it is, since the stipulation of capacity for perfection of imitation when desired is attributed. It will look like fate as long as it wants to look like fate. But if it cares to disclose itself as actually being a higher intelligent will, if it even does so, it then can. and the problem is solved. By the way, I define fate and higher intelligent will in that I see no tragedy in bowing to the latter. For me, to find that I had been broken by the latter and not the former would, by all means, induce specifically exaltation. The mystery of the guessed at reality would certainly deepen, but become even more reassuring if I suspected that in some supernatural fashion this higher intelligent will could be identified or equated with my own covert enlightened will, a web of harmony underlying or transcending the antithetical clash which had pulverized my conscious plans. Exaltation is precisely my response to my direct knowledge and experience of Valis, of my awareness of its authority over the irrational, which I identify with astral determinism or fate. I especially exult in my sense of Valis having invaded the irrational as a conqueror.